An old French fairy tale, well, it's actually a story, of two daughters. The one was bad, the other was good. The bad daughter was the favorite of her mother, but the good daughter was very unjustly treated and neglected and despised. And one day, while drawing water from the village well, the good daughter met a poor woman who asked for a drink. And the girl responded with kind words and gave the woman a cup of water. And the woman, who was actually a fairy in disguise, was so pleased with the little girl's kindness and good manners that she gave her a gift. "Each time you speak," said the woman, "a flower or a jewel will come out of your mouth." And when the little girl got home, the mother was just scolding her for taking so long to bring that water. And the girl started to apologize, and out came two roses and two pearls, a diamond. Her mother was astonished. But after hearing the girl's story, she sent her other daughter to go to the well and also collect the same gift. But the bad daughter was very reluctant to be seen performing the lowly task of drawing water, and she just grumbled sourly all the way to the well. And when the bad daughter got to the well, a beautiful, queenly woman, the same fairy in another disguise, came by and asked for a drink. Disagreeable and proud, the girl responded rudely. And as a result, she also received a gift. And each time she opened her mouth, she emitted snakes and frogs. How's that for poetic justice? There's something in each of us that longs for circumstances to be fair, isn't it? Maybe that's why fairy tales are so appealing, because good people receive their just reward. They live happily ever after, while bad people are soundly punished. Life works out, justice is done, and fairness reigns supreme. Unfortunately, that's not reality. It doesn't always turn out that way. And every child needs to be taught life isn't always fair. In fact, fairness is rare. When my son Chips graduated from Ravenscroft High School in Raleigh, our Scottish minister, Dr. Al Edwards, was the commencement speaker that year, and he began his message by quoting M. Scott Peck from his book, A Road Less Traveled. "Life is difficult. This is a great truth. Our lives are haunted by unfairness when we want fairness, and instead of justice, we are surrounded by injustice. We want deceit exposed and dishonesty revealed and truth rewarded, but things don't always work out that way, at least not as we perceive them. Some families have been racked by unfairness. A mate leaves a loving, faithful partner. And disease steals a loved one prematurely. An unfair situation at work or at school keeps escalating. Life doesn't turn out to be fair for many. Well, for most, actually. Truly, life is difficult. But therein lies some of life's best lessons." I was reminded of these words when I read the astonishing statement by a well-known British writer. He says, "Contrary to what might be expected, I look back on experiences that at the time seemed especially desolating, painful, with particular satisfaction. Indeed, I can say with complete truthfulness that everything I have learned in my 75 years in this world, everything that has truly enhanced and enlightened my existence, has been through affliction and not through happiness." In other words, if I were ever to be possible to eliminate affliction from our earthly existence by means of some drug or some medical mumbo-jumbo, the result would not to be make life delectable, but to make it too banal and trivial to be endurable. This, of course, is what the cross signifies. And it is the cross, more than anything else, that has called me inexorably to Christ. Now, it's one thing to read these words by Malcolm Muckeridge and to be moved. It's another thing to embrace them in our own lives. I doubt if there's anyone here who hasn't at some time had reason to become bitter the way you were treated by someone because of some unfair experience. Everyone can blame someone for something. As Christians, we know that ultimately goodwill will triumph over evil, and that our God is just. He is kind and fair. But what can we do with the injustices and the unfairnesses that we experience? How can we keep pressing on in spite of such mistreatment? Chuck Swindoll points out two different and distinct perspectives. Our response to unfairness, as well as all other issues, he writes, is based on our perspective, the particular vantage point from which we look at life. And basically, in this case, we have two perspectives to choose from, the human perspective or the divine. Our natural human perspective contends, sure, since life isn't fair, I'm going to get my share. I'm going to look out for number one. I'm going to spend my energy getting even, getting my own back, setting things straight, making it right. I'm not going to take it any longer. Our world is full of literature and counselors who will help you carry out that agenda. The problem is you may get even, but you won't get peace. You may feel better for the short term, but you won't get lasting satisfaction. You may find a way to channel your anger, but if retaliation is your major goal, you will not glorify God. Those who live their lives from that perspective are more likely to end their lives as bitter, cynical, hostile people. And tragically, I have described how the majority of America chooses to live. Fortunately, we have another opinion, and we found it last week in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 12. For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil. The principle is this: God misses nothing. He's looking out for us. He sees the evil. He's listening to our prayers. He's completely aware of everything that's happening to us. Don't you ever think that he's missed it? He sees, he remembers. He may be long-suffering, but he doesn't compromise his justice. Not only is his eye on the righteous, his face is against evil, and ultimately, good will overcome evil. In the end, God wins. But if this is true, we often feel, why doesn't he do something about evil right now? Why does he let the things happen and go on so long? God's timeline is infinite. He doesn't close his books at the end of the month. It may take a lifetime or longer before justice is served, but in the end, you can count on it. God will be just. He'll work everything together for his good, for his glory. And that thought gives each of us hope beyond bitterness. If we don't believe that, and if we don't focus on that, we become the losers. And ultimately, in our aging years, we can become angry old men and jaded old women. Building on a divine perspective, Peter gives us five ways, they're in your notes, in an unfair and inequitable world. But first, there's a general principle that we find in our scripture. We need to underscore 1 Peter 3:13. And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? if we were to paraphrase that verse, we could say that those who live honest lives will not usually suffer harm. Usually. There's the rub. There are exceptions, of course, to every rule, but as a general rule, if you live a life of purity, a life of integrity, in the long run, you usually won't suffer as much as those who habitually traffic in evil. For example, if you pay your debts, chances are good that you won't get into financial trouble. If you pay all your taxes on time, you probably won't have the IRS on your back. If you take care of your body and get sufficient exercise and sleep and watch your diet and stress level, chances are good that you'll live a healthier life. Our family right now, Chips and Angie and Corey, they're going on a keto diet. It's a new diet. I saw checking out of Target a little book, Keto for Women Over 50. And since my daughter-in-law had just turned 50, I thought about buying her that book. I left it on the shelf. If you help others, chances are good when you need help, others will help you. To paraphrase Peter's principle, those who do right are usually not in harm's way. Usually that's the rule. But because life is difficult, there are times when life just ain't fair. There will be times when, despite that general principle, despite your righteous life, despite your faithfulness and your walk with God, situations will turn on you. And it's these exceptions to the rule that Peter addresses right here in 1 Peter 3, verses 13 through 17. I remember Henry Ford made a comment one time, when everything seems to be going against you, remember that the airplane takes off against the wind, not with it. Max Lucado, in his delightful book, How Happiness Happens, points out, we all have a buster. Maybe two, maybe 10. I haven't seen the buster that I knew in decades, but I see his type almost weekly. When the young wife told me about her abusive husband, I thought of Buster. When I read about the kid who was bullied in high school, I think about Buster. A corporation bought a small business, cleared house, fired everyone. That's Buster at work. Perhaps your Buster was your dad who came at you daily. Your Buster said, I loved you when you were young and slender, and then said, I don't want you when you became older and rounder. Buster flunked you out of spite. Your Buster cheated on you. Your Buster abandoned you. You've been bustered. And maybe you've moved on, but if not, that's a question that needs to be raised regarding your happiness. I quote, resentment sucks satisfaction from your soul. Bitterness consumes it. Revenge is a monster with a monstrous appetite. One act of retaliation is never enough. 1 pound of flesh is never enough. Left unchecked, grudges send us on a downward spiral. Your Buster took much. Are you going to let him take even more? Brood at great risk. Is life sweeter when you are sour? Is it any better when you're grim, gloomy? Of course not. Ecclesiastes 7:9, it is foolish to harbor a grudge. Some people abandon the path of forgiveness because it just seems like an impossible climb. But let's be realistic. Forgiveness doesn't pardon the offense or excuse the misdeed or ignore it. Forgiveness is not necessarily reconciliation. A reestablished relationship with the transgressor is not essential and or even always possible. But even more, the phrase forgive and forget, it just sets an unreachable standard. Painful memories they're kind of like, they're not like old clothing. They defy easy shedding. Forgiveness is simply the act of changing your attitude toward the offender. It's moving from a desire to harm toward an experience to desire peace. A step in the direction of forgiveness is a decisive step toward happiness. When researchers at Duke University listed 8 factors that promoted emotional stability, 4 of them related to forgiveness. 1, avoiding suspicion and resentment. 2, not living in the past. 3, not wasting time and energy fighting conditions that can't be changed. And 4, refusing to indulge in self-pity when you're handed a raw deal. In a paper titled Granting Forgiveness or Harboring Grudges, researchers relate how they invited people to reflect on a person who had caused them deep harm. And just the thought of the perpetrator led to sweaty palms and facial muscle tension, a higher heart rate, increased blood pressure. And when the subjects were instructed to imagine the possibilities of forgiveness, all of the above physiological issues were reversed. Health and happiness happened when forgiveness begins to flow. We quoted Paul last week in one of his one another scriptures, this one found in Ephesians 4:32. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. Forgiveness is a big deal. We need to practice it. Peter begins here in verse 14 with a general summation of when life just ain't fair. But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. Then Peter goes on to suggest the 5 ways if situations turn on us. Now, this isn't my advice. This is God's advice. Human says, kick him in the teeth, get even. But that's not, as you know, not good advice. But it's often heard. So we need to know what God has to say about how to respond when we've been done what is right, not right. When we have done what is right, but wrong is done to us in return. And it might be help if you would help or keep these responses down, keep them handy. Diana likes to write things on a little 3x5 card to look back on it again. It's a pretty good idea. You might want to stick these on your bathroom mirror, slip them under the glass plate on your desk. How are we to respond when the exception to the rule occurs? Well, first, we need to consider ourselves uniquely blessed by God. As far as injustice itself is concerned, Peter's surprising advice is to be happy, to consider yourself blessed. James tells us something similar in James 1:2. He says, when all kinds of trials and temptations crowd into your life, my brothers, don't resent them as intruders. Welcome them as friends. Sure sounds nice. You may say, but honestly now, how can we be happy and consider ourselves blessed when we've just been punched in the eye by a fist of injustice? Well, we can remember this by doing 2 things. First, we can see as earlier in 1 Peter in 2:21, we're called to patiently endure unfair treatment so that when it comes, we will know that we are still experiencing God's plan and his purpose in our lives. We're fulfilling our calling. God's hand is still there. And someday we will be rewarded for our endurance if these undeserved trials. Matthew 5:10, James 1:12. From Insight for Living, the second response to poor treatment for righteous living is to refrain from panic and worry. We find that in verse 14, and do not fear their intimidation. Do not be troubled. There's no reason to fear your enemy's methods of intimidation or be troubled. The Greek word for fear is phobio, from which we get our word phobia. It implies fleeing or avoiding something, and the word trouble refers to shaking up and intimidating seriously. Jesus used it in John 14:1. He tells his disciples, don't let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. The background of Peter's call to avoid panic and worrying is found in Isaiah chapter 8, where the Lord called on his people Israel to turn away from fear and dread of those pagan nations that were threatening to undo them. Instead of fearing and trembling before the nations, they were to rely on God's promises, tremble before him alone. And we can rely on his promises. We have an unshakable hope. In fact, Isaiah's call to regard the Lord as holy leads us to Peter's third response to mistreatment. To acknowledge Christ as Lord. Chuck Swindoll, Hope Again. You and I can do that in prayer. When we think a wrong has been done to us that we don't deserve, we can respond, Lord, you're with me right now. You're here. You have your reasons for what's happening. You will not take advantage of me. You'll be kind. You're much too good to be unjust. You care for me too much to let this get out of hand. Take charge. Use my integrity to defend me. Give me the grace to stay calm. Control my emotions. Be Lord over my present situation. And in such a prayer, we set Christ apart as Lord in our hearts. We say, take over, Lord. You be the sovereign master over this moment. I can't change that person. I can't alter these circumstances. You be the Lord over this scene. Acknowledge Christ as Lord. And that takes me to another scene, a personal one. Our son Chips had completed freshman year at the University of Colorado in Boulder and had enrolled in the forestry program at NC State in Raleigh. He liked living on campus, and he was enjoying his jacked-up Toyota pickup truck. The call came 2:30 Sunday morning, not good. The mother of his best friend who was riding with him as the pickup rolled over on the interstate exit ramp was calling. The state trooper had alerted her that both boys had been ambulanced to Wake Memorial Hospital and were in intensive care. We rushed from our house and, please, Lord, please. We have no idea what we are facing, but take charge. Save our son. Be our Lord and Master. We're trusting you. Please, please help us. When we arrived and told the ER receptionist who we were, she said, please sit over there. The chaplain will be with you in a moment. And Carolyn turned out and went out the door and threw up on the street. Finally, a doctor came and he let us know that Chips was still alive. We're trying to reduce the bleeding and the swelling on his brain. We're taking extensive x-rays to assess his condition. We just waited a couple hours, just praying fervently. When we were admitted to the ICU, Chips was still out, but we audibly prayed close to his ear, asking God to watch over that child and restore him. And thankfully, God heard our heart's cry. Today, Chips is fine. He recovered with no lasting damage. But whatever the outcome, as hard as it could have been, we would still believe that God was in control. He would still be Lord. I taught Sunday school later that morning. Bearing witness and grateful testimony to an awesome God. Which brings us to four. Be ready to give a witness. Verse 15, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give account of the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. William Barclay gives an excellent explanation of what our defense and account should be like. It must be reasonable. It is a logos that the Christian must give, and a logos is a reasonable and intelligent statement of his position. To do so, we must know what we believe, we must have thought it out, we must be able to state it intelligently, and in his defense must be given with gentleness. The case for Christianity must be presented with winsomeness and with love. People may be wooed into the Christian faith. They can't be bullied into it. His defense must be given with reverence. That is to say, any argument in which the Christian is involved must be carried out in a tone that God can hear with joy. In any presentation of the Christian case, in any argument for the Christian faith, the accent should be the accent of love. And fifth, keep a good conscience. And here Peter brings below the surface, he digs in, turning up the rich soil of inner character. And what precious gem is he trying to reveal? Integrity. Keep a good conscience, Peter writes, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. Nothing speaks louder or more powerfully than a life of integrity. Absolutely nothing. Nothing stands the test like a solid character. You can handle the blast like a blizzard, like a bull, a buffalo standing. The snow is on his horns and the wind is raging, but you keep standing because Christ is at work in your spirit. He is within us. Character will always win the day. Horace Greeley put it this way: fame is a vapor, popularity an accident, riches take wing, only character endures. So the underlying and unwavering principle is found in verse 17, for it is better if God should will it so that you suffer for doing what is right than for doing what is wrong. Simply stated, that's the principle. Unjust suffering is always better than deserved punishment. And sometimes, though we cannot fully explain why, it's God's will that God's people should suffer for doing what is right. Hear this personal story by Chuck Swindoll. Dr. Bruce Waltke was my Hebrew professor during the last 3 years I was at Dallas Seminary. He has since become something of a mentor and a dear friend. He's a brilliant man with a tender heart for God. And when I was going through a very difficult time in my senior year, I wanted some answers to the whys. Bruce said something like this: Chuck, I've come to the place where only on rare occasions does God tell us why. I've simply decided to stop asking. I found that to be very helpful counsel. From that point on, I began to acknowledge that I'm not the answer man for events in life that just don't make logical human sense. I am now convinced that even if he does explain his reasons, I would seldom understand. His ways are higher, far more profound than our finite minds can comprehend. So now I accept God's directions. I live with them as best I can. And frankly, I leave it at that. I have found that such a response not only relieves me, it gives me hope beyond bitterness. Pretty good counsel. So if God has asked you to suffer for his sake, remember that the Lord is not only full of compassion, he is in full control. He will not leave you without hope. We have those verses in Isaiah 55. My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours. My thoughts higher than your thoughts. Proverbs 16:7. When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. A good conscience removes from us the fear of what other people may know about us or say about us or do against us. When Christ is Lord, when we fear only God and not fear the threats or opinions or actions of others, the Lord is on my side, we read in Psalm 118:6. I will not fear. What can man do unto me? More and more, I believe Christians in today's society are going to face suffering, going to be accused, lied about. Our personal standards are not those of the unsaved world. And as a rule, Christians do not create problems. They reveal them. Ephesians 5:11, Christians are lights in this dark world. That's Philippians 2:15. Ephesians 5:11, they reveal the unfruitful works of darkness. So as times of difficulty come, we as Christians, we must love. We need each other's help and encouragement as never before. We need to maintain a good conscience. Become a good conscience makes for a strong backbone, a courageous witness. The secret is to practice the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Make him Lord of our life. If we fear God, we need not fear men. Samuel Johnson said, shame arises from the fear of man, conscience from the fear of God. We have our marching orders right there in 1 Peter 3:15. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Selah.